It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Life is not supposed to be this way. I'm talking about the pandemic here. Our minds are not built to deal with a deadly global pandemic. We're not mentally set up to live in constant fear of breathing. Our brains aren't used to the intense, protracted isolation and having no knowledge of when it will end. Kids aren't supposed to go to school in their bedrooms. None of this is supposed to be this way. And then there's your job. If you go to work but wear a mask all day because of the constant threat of infection and possible death, remember, work's not supposed to be like that. If your office is shut down and you now work from the kitchen table, maybe managing your kids' schoolwork at the same time, it's not supposed to be like that. And that dissonance adds up. That affects your mind. That weighs you down. It's a lot to carry. So it's no wonder that burnout at work is a huge thing right now. Being unmotivated at a job that used to fire you up, being exhausted in the face of even doing your job, feeling like you have nothing to give. You get increasingly unmotivated, ineffective, cynical. We're going to hear the burnout experiences of you, the listener, here in a little bit. But first, Jennifer Moss is a researcher and journalist specializing in burnout. She recently wrote about some new findings on the subject at the Harvard Business Review, and she has a forthcoming book, The Burnout Epidemic. I asked for her definition of burnout.
Well, I actually like to refer to the WHO definition. The World Health Organization just announced in 2019 that burnout is really the result of unmanaged stress at work. So the fact that they define it as an occupational phenomena is a big deal because researchers have really been pushing for us to kind of contextualize it as a workplace problem so that more employers are accountable to burnout versus us just having to solve it individually. So it's trying to get people to understand that it's a we problem to solve. Burnout isn't just something like we're an individual match, you know, suddenly blown out. It's about a long-term sort of unmanagement or chronic stress that eventually breaks us.
Now, I saw the headline of that burnout was now listed in the International Classification of Diseases, but not exactly as a disease. Can you explain that?
So it's not a medical condition. And when they did put it into the, the ICD, people were all frantic and they were saying now it's a disease that needs to be treated. And then they had to backtrack, the World Health Organization had to backtrack to say, actually, you know, it isn't necessarily a diagnosable medical condition, but it's important because there are symptoms that, you know, that can make us unwell are a byproduct of burnout. There are places like Sweden, actually, it's the only one in the world that does actually look at burnout as an illness that is treated with, you know, pharmacological responses and actual support. Of course, it's in Sweden, you know, and that's why, you know, they're 10 steps ahead when it comes to mental health, but they call it severe exhaustion disorder there, but it's pretty much the same symptoms of burnout as we would identify it in North America.
The way you describe burnout is almost a naturally occurring phenomenon. Like if the environment is right and enough stress gets built up, here's what will happen almost inevitably.
You know, there's root causes of burnout, and they often, if not always, go back to infrastructure that is going badly inside of organizations. So bad policy, actually refer to the research often around hygiene and motivation. So hygiene is just the table stakes stuff. You know, you need to pay people. You need to not be bullied at work. You have to have a sustainable workload. You know, you have to be paid for what you're worth and how much you're working. And, you know, these system problems that cause burnout when they're not being managed. And it's really tragic, actually, how often these systems are broken and hygiene is just, you know, poorly run inside of an organization. And that almost always is a predictor for burnout. But then if you want to talk about motivation, which is this like other, it's separate. You can't really have motivation unless basic hygiene needs have been met. So you have to actually, it's almost like the triangle, you know, at the base, you need to have have the basic needs met, hygiene. And what happens with this motivation piece, which are the perks and the extras and the bonuses and all that other stuff, what happens is that a lot of employers flip that around and they have motivation as part of their strategies, but they don't necessarily, they haven't checked to make sure that the basic needs are being met. And so that's where we need to start thinking, like, how do we get to basic hygiene all the time, never a question? Because employees actually don't notice it being neutral. Like, you get paid what you're worth. You don't think about it. It's not a motivation factor. But if it's not there, you feel it so exponentially. Yeah. You know, I talk about in one example of the coffee in one company, they had like a barista and stuff and a coffee maker, and they had this free coffee for a few years, and then times went south. And so then they had to take the coffee away. And employees were like, they didn't really notice the coffee being there. They just enjoyed it. But when someone came and took it away, it was like they lost about 20% of their workforce because they felt like it was just the most tone deaf thing to do amongst layoffs. And, you know, in the middle of all of this stuff, why not just keep the damn coffee? And so they were so angry about that. And that's sort of that idea of hygiene needs to be table stakes. And then the other stuff is bonus.
Well, I would think if you don't have the hygiene, if you don't have the fundamentals taken care of, then the motivation can feel a lot more existential. Like, you better achieve this goal or this will vanish too. You know, this will all collapse because we don't really care about you. So you're kind of fighting for your life all the time.
Absolutely. And when you think like how systemic this is and how rampant this is, you know, when we have women making only 70 cents on the dollar on average, you know, compared to their male counterparts, that's basically around the world. So there's always a layer of a root cause of burnout happening at all times where hygiene is not being met unless you have an organization that is purely equal pay. And so when we think about the systemic causes of burnout, it's happening all the time, everywhere, until we can solve for that. I mean, that's just one example of many, but that's what I'm talking about. It's so big that we need to be thinking about the fact that, you know, it's tackling some of these big issues, because if not, you'll never have hygiene. You'll never have hygiene in your organizations. And if you don't have hygiene, you can never motivate. So you're always just, you know, you're over rotating on something that won't have a solution.
And then what does burnout look like classically? Like, when we've had this bad system operating and it's starting to show up on the people, what are the telltale symptoms?
So Dr. Christina Maslach and Dr. Michael Leiter, along with Dr. Susan Jackson, they all have been working in this space around, you know, understanding and diagnosing burnout for a really long time. They actually developed the MBI, which is the Maslach Burnout Inventory, and it's the scale that helps us understand if we're, you know, going to be burning out, or if we're at risk of burnout, or if we're burnt out, you know. And what they look at is just frequency of these feelings of disengagement. Basically, you have a really hard time getting motivated in the morning to go to work. You're sort of dreading that feeling. By the end of the day, you're completely exhausted by your work. It just makes you feel so tired. And then one of the biggest predictors is cynicism. So you don't feel like it's going to change. You just feel like this is how it's always going to be, that you have lost total control over making those changes. And so eventually it gets to the point where, you know, you're so unwell that you burn out and you have to get help for that.
And you've been part of some of this research that you wrote about recently in the Harvard Business Review, that when I read that article, I guess my conclusion is, oh, things are very, very bad out there. could you walk us through where we stand now, a year into COVID and operating in some of these systems?
It was actually heartbreaking to read the qualitative responses that we got with our survey. And, you know, we hit 46 different countries. So we got a really large swath of data across a lot of different groups. And we looked specifically in workplaces. So we're separated out for workplaces. But what we found was that people are extremely burned out. I mean, some of the data was, you know, 89% of people said their well-being had diminished in the last year. I mean, only 2% 2% of the population of our respondents said that their well-being was excellent. Most people said that they were dramatically impacted. Friendships were being strained. People were feeling lonely and disconnected. So this year has had a really huge impact on us as human beings collectively. But then you add this workforce stress around Zoom burnout and video conferencing and workload increases and trying to do all that under this fog of, you know, of worry and fear and anxiety, it's just exacerbated a major problem. I say it's basically lit a match to a workforce in drought. And we are now seeing the ramifications of not actually properly addressing burnout for way too long.
Did the numbers surprise you as a burnout expert that they were that bad?
When you start to get into like 90%, it's surprising. I mean, I knew it was tough and I knew a lot of people were struggling. But when you talk, we actually had Dr. Leiter and Dr. Maslach both sort of review the data, and they said that it's some of the most burned out, you know, group of people that they've seen across their data over decades. So there's something to be said about this year and how it's just dramatically increased the number of people burned out than we've seen before.
And what was happening with these numbers before COVID? Were they already heading this way?
Well, we were seeing a whole bunch of factors play into why people were burning out already. Isolation and loneliness were majorly on the rise. We're seeing more people in single occupancy dwellings, and that happens to also be on the rise in urban centers where there's a lot of people in the knowledge-based economy working. And so all of those factors around the isolation and loneliness were a problem. Burnout in general, we're seeing workload increasing. Certain sectors are already at high risk, you know, in the healthcare field. This was a big problem pre-COVID. We saw suicide rates of male physicians about 40 times above the average, and female physicians were 130 times above the average because of just compassion fatigue and, you know, a whole bunch of other perfectionist concerns that hit that group, plus the legacy of overwork. So we're already seeing these issues on the rise, a lot of money being spent on trying to battle burnout and not really effectively doing a good job of it. But then you have something like a crisis, and it just takes a big problem and, you know, makes it way bigger.
More with Jennifer Moss in a moment. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh. You write about in the Harvard Business Review that the approach a lot of companies take is centered on this being an employee problem. Like, if you're burnt out, you better fix yourself, because the train's chugging along with or without you. And you talk about this being a very dangerous and ineffective approach. Could you explain that a bit?
You know, this is one of the things that has frustrated me for years, is this idea that, you know, maybe we should just have a well-being strategy by bringing on a new app. You know, say you're feeling really burned out and you're overworked and there's systemic, you know, inequality, there's poor, you know, programs around inclusion. But here's an app. If you listen to Rain for 30 seconds, it's just going to cure all of your problems. And we don't have any responsibility to that. And it just makes me just so frustrated. And so part of writing the book was to just sound the alarm on the strategies employers were using to prevent burnout. They're not working. And I think it's just a lack of understanding of what burnout really is, you know, them understanding that what their role is to play in that. And we often do sort of mix up well-being tactics with our burnout strategies. And that is causing a lot of harm. And it's actually creating a lack of trust between leaders and their people, because everyone feels like it's just tone deaf. You know, you're not addressing the real problems here. Why are you asking me to, you know, do these Zoom yoga classes when I can barely manage homeschooling with my kids, you know, flying around in the background? I don't have time. And so what happens is well-being is just added to workload. And that's not really what we need to be doing. We need to be looking way, way, way further upstream in our interventions to prevent burnout downstream.
It seems like it's become, if anything, harder to detect, because, okay, now you're going to work from home. You can wear pajamas. You can wear sweatpants. You can, you know, put off some work to do later so you can spend some time with your kids in the afternoon. But it really sets up a thing where you live at work. You know, you're always on the job. The monster, the phone call is coming from inside of the house at all times.
It's coming from the attic. Yeah, I love that. And it's a really big myth that working from home in a pandemic is the same as working from home not in a pandemic. And so Right. We've sort of decided these major, you know, strategic decisions around work from home in the middle of a time where there's no frame of reference. So even just a couple months of productivity data that some of these companies have taken and said, oh yeah, everyone's productive, we should now start to work from home forever, not understanding that this is not actually what it's like to work from home. And there's so much more data we need to gather around what this looks like and how sustainable it is. And the fact that people aren't going to see other people, we've seen, you know, a huge rise in people feeling extremely lonely and isolated. People that are introverts actually claim that working from home is just their death. That it's, as much as we think that if you're an introvert, it's better to be working from home, actually, for a lot of people, being at work is their sort of time that they get out of their shell, or they're connecting with people in a way that's really healthy for them. So we're pulling all that away in a time where it is not business as usual. And so I think there's going to be sort of a long-term impact from that. And employers are going to be kind of clawing back some of these decisions that they've made in a time where it's completely abnormal.
I haven't normally talked a lot about burnout on the work that I've done. I don't talk a lot about the workspace. I think usually in terms of an inner life, but, you know, I think about all the conversations I've had with people with depression. And one of the most fundamental things I've learned is that there is an innate sense, an instinct to blame yourself. You know, at the root of this all, at the root of all your problems with depression is you weren't strong enough. You weren't brave enough. You weren't smart enough. You didn't put in the time. And it covers up the tracks of the fact that there's an actual problem that goes much, much deeper. And I wonder if that is common in the workplace across the board, this sense that not just on the part of the companies, but on the part of the employee. Like, if I'm suffering, that's on me. I've got to change to fit the place.
Absolutely. We can't individualize the problem. And one of the things that we did learn from the data as well is that people that it was actually 67% of the people that reported that they couldn't talk about mental health at work were burned out. And that was compared to those people who felt like they could talk about mental health at work. So when we say it's just on you, we're actually you know, adding all of these other potential risks of burnout and chronic stress and other things that actually exacerbate depression, you know? So the workplace needs to be an environment where there's psychological safety and the ability to have those conversations. And for some people too, just isolating away from sort of mechanically the ability to have serendipitous moments of connecting with someone is really hard and increasing on mental health, but it's increasing depression this year because of that social isolation. So I think there's just a whole bunch of factors, like the ability to talk about mental health, having policies that make it really open, have those conversations, whether virtual or in person, and then figuring out ways for us to actually reconnect in a way that's meaningful so that we can build those relationships that foster or sort of act as a prophylaxis to depression.
It's funny, like I consider myself a bit of an introvert. I like staying home and reading a book and petting the dog, you know, as much as the next introvert. But there is something medicinal, even now, like, you know, wearing a mask, going to a coffee shop, interacting with the barista, or, you know, being on a walk on a nice day and sensing other people around you. There's like a passive socializing that you get to do that's just been all shot to hell through all this COVID.
Yeah, we've sort of lost our humanity. The part of, you know, the reason for mirror neurons that can only be activated when you're actually physically, you know, connected in real life with people is part of our survival. It's how, you know, we had strength in numbers.
There's safety in that group, yeah.
There's a safety in that group. And so just not having that. And that's a really interesting thing too. I do a radio column, and the one that I'm doing tomorrow is a year without friends and on our mental health. And so a big part of that is just, we're not meant to have a lot of friends. It's not about quantity. We're actually, according to Dunbar number, we're supposed to only have 5 close friends, the ones that, you know, will pick us up from the airport. That's all we need really. And one of those friends, they say it should be one good friend at work, you know, whether virtual or in person. But we need to feel those connections again, like with the barista, like with the people in the grocery store that you run into, like with your neighbors that you sit and talk to, or when you're walking your dog. Without that, our survival is feeling threatened. And so that cortisol and those chemicals that induce depression like feelings are not, you know, are being just triggered over and over and over again. And so there's all these things that are happening that we don't even realize. So blaming yourself isn't accurate, because there's so many external factors this year that we have no control of that are just making it harder on our mental health.
I just think, and forgive me for going a little Marxist here, but in a capitalist society where these organizations are driven by increasing the profits and growing and increasing more profits, isn't the dehumanization and the disposability of the worker just an unavoidable conclusion, an unavoidable path that sort of points like, you know, yeah, burnout's just going to be the cost of doing business?
You know, that's a great question. And you know, I've done a lot of historical analysis of the workforce, and transactional relationships with employees have been the MO for centuries. So we're only now realizing that there is this difference between just keeping the basic hygiene alive and then also motivating people. And that when you do have both of those working really well, it increases all of those, you know, profits and shareholder returns, and, you know, you get better retention. And so the more data that we're gathering around the benefits of actually preventing burnout and the costs associated with people burning out, the deep impact that is creating for our bottom line or impacting our bottom line, you're seeing more people switch, and you're seeing more transformational leadership discussions. You're seeing more conversations around how do we actually, you know, keep people for longer than a year and just spitting them out, because they're very expensive to attract and retain.
Right.
The problem with an economic crisis like this last one, and then 2008 and the ones previous, is that what happens is that people end up, you know, overqualifying for jobs. There's this indebted servitude that they have to having a job. You see this, you know, this real issue and impact of people going into work and staying for the wrong reasons. And so employers then also can get, you know, greedy in that they say, okay, we can have a whole bunch of cheap talent and it doesn't matter that they're overqualified. But there's a lot of data that says that we have to be careful around that relationship between hiring talent, understanding that that's going to burn people out. And so there's a lot of real learning that has to come over this last year that I think is going to translate into some really big strategic decisions being made in organizations.
What should someone do if they feel like they're on the track towards burnout at their job?
It's a good question because sometimes we don't even see it. I mean, it's sort of like how depression can come sometimes sneak up on us too. Mm-hmm. It's something that we're doing, we're feeling. We should be asking ourselves the frequency of some of those feelings, like I mentioned, that the MBI scores for. We should be saying to ourselves, you know, how often am I feeling motivated in the morning? How often do I feel exhausted at the end of the day? And start to sort of track it. Am I feeling this a lot? Well, then I'm probably at risk of burnout. So that means having hard conversations with your peers and having hard conversations with your boss. But we can come to our managers with solutions to say, here is my workload. It's really high. Here are some strategies. I think I can, you know, still productively meet goals, but this is how I can reduce the strain. You know, these are the hours that I suggest. This is where it could be flexible. So I think coming to managers with really good solutions about how to manage and prevent burnout is important. We need to make it more safe for women in particular to ask for raises. And, you know, we need to have those kind of conversations. We need to have dissenting opinions. So I suggest that we start having meetings where there's one person that wears, I call it the black robe, you know, play the RBG role and be the dissenting opinion. And you actually move every person around the group to have the capacity to do that. So we create more of these, you know, conversations that make it safe to speak up. You know, these kind of things can tactically be brought into our organizations and even amongst peers. If our manager might not be, you know, as involved, we can do this amongst our coworkers. So we sort of have to, you know, slowly start to build that in. But it is challenging if it's not an acceptable practice at work. So that all, it all needs to kind of change in tandem, which makes solving for burnout actually really complicated and difficult thing to do. But I always feel like when everything's up in the air, you know, and I talk about that in the article, everything's up for grabs. Like now is the time to kind of, you know, jump in there and take the risk. Yeah, but it's a complicated problem to solve. And so I feel like a lot more education around what it really is and how to solve for it will be the answer in the coming years.
In the past year, I've gone from working for a large organization to starting my own company, of which I'm the only employee. So now, if I go take a nap, it's also an employee enrichment program.
When we are our own bosses, yeah, we can run the risk of burning ourselves out. I know. And then we can also run the risk of really giving ourselves some fantastic policies. So I think we just need to err on the side of making, you know, choices that are good for us versus choices that are not good for us.
That's Jennifer Moss. You can find more of her writing and speaking at her site, jennifer-moss.com. Jennifer's book, The Burnout Epidemic, is available for pre-order. You can find it online where books are sold. In just a moment, your stories. We asked our listeners for their own tales of burnout. You'll want to listen, see how many, aha, that's just like me, moments you can rack up.
I'm Judge John Hodgman.
And I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne.
10 years ago, I came on Jordan Jesse Go and judged my first dispute. Is chili a soup? It's a stew, obviously.
The judge has dispensed a decade of justice. He's the one person wise enough to answer the really important questions. Like, should you hire a mime to perform at your own funeral?
After they cry, I want them to laugh.
Do you really need a tank full of jellyfish in your den?
They smell like living creatures decaying.
Only if they are decaying.
Yeah, which they will be.
Real people, real justice, real comedy.
Winner of the Webby Award for Best Comedy Podcast.
The Judge John Hodgman Podcast, every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org.
Hey, I'm Janet Varney, host of the JV Club Podcast. Ah, high school. Was it a time of adventure, romance, and discovery?
Class of 95, we did it!
Or a time of angst, disappointment, and confusion?
We're all tied together by 4 years of trauma at this place, but enjoy adulthood, I guess.
The truth is, it was both. So join me on the JV Club podcast, where I invite some great friends like Kristen Bell, Angela Kinsey, Oscar Nunez, Neil Patrick Harris, and Keegan Michael Key to talk about high school, the good, the bad, and everything in between.
My teenage mood swings are getting harder to manage.
The JV Club. Find it on Maximum Fun.
So it's one thing to learn about burnout, to hear some very alarming statistics. 89% of people have a diminished sense of well-being. Good Lord. But I think we can understand burnout even more by talking with people who have lived it. I talked with some Depression Mode listeners about what burnout has felt like in their lives and in their jobs. Rob works in the Foreign Service. He had been on a job abroad and returned stateside to a new, kind of ambiguous position.
So you got to the new job, but there was no place to go to for the new job except your house.
Exactly, yeah. So there's already no separation, difficult to find the separation between work and home life. And I didn't really receive, looking back, didn't really receive the training that I would have liked for this position.
You don't often hear about someone getting burnt out at the very beginning of a job, but it sounds like that's exactly what was happening.
Well, yes, I think I was already feeling a little bit overcome by all the coronavirus experience, plus the work that I had been doing in Africa was very intense. So was probably ready for a break. I started to think about my computer as really, it was a little bit of magical thinking, I guess. I would have to actually get it out of sight. I couldn't look at it between work hours. And same with my phone. It was getting worse and it was feeling, and it's at this point hard to disentangle what is burnout and what is depression. I'm still in the job and still trying to figure out what to do next.
Mary lives in Maine. She remembers a time when things got pretty intense at her retail job and she kind of checked out.
The company itself sold to a larger corporate buyer. And they started changing the processes of how we were able to sell to customers and the way we were able to interact with customers. And we ended up having a lot of people kind of flooding and calling this small store that I worked at. It was really overwhelming. I had already dealt with just the social anxiety that comes with working with customers and having to kind of wear that customer service mask every day. The burnout really set in when I started feeling really kind of in a place of just being stuck. It was a pretty hollow type of feeling. I also deal with depression, so when I go into those sort of depressive states, I kind of start feeling like a shell of myself. And it was similar with the burnout where it was like, I was just kind of on autopilot. Okay, get up, go to work, go, do the tasks that are associated with work. But I kind of had to shut down the sort of feeling side that I had just to kind of get through the day.
Jonathan's in Texas. He says the pandemic has had a direct effect on his job in IT.
The ability to care about work is something that I've watched slip away over this time. I can't give any rational justification that says, well, it mattered then, it doesn't matter now, because it does matter now. And I've got a wife and I've got kids and I've got a mortgage. And for me to just say, screw it, I can't do this anymore, would impact more people than just me now. You know, COVID has had an impact on one thing, which is that about this time last year, I mustered all of my energy and sense of hope and reached out and contacted a psychiatrist's office to do an intake appointment for depression. And that was literally when COVID-19 struck. So they had to cancel my appointment and didn't get back to me on rescheduling. And I haven't restarted that. So I'm just coasting along as I have been. So either I'll get help and pull myself out of this rut, or I'll change jobs and everything will be different and magical. Because, that's how it goes, right?
Jonathan, please call them back. Everyone, please make those appointments. Keep those appointments. Be persistent.
A lot of the listeners I talked to match up really well with what Jennifer Moss told us earlier in the show. People are describing a lack of institutional hygiene. They're given more work and more stress without more capacity to get that work done. And with COVID, a lot of folks have had to make an office out of, like, their kitchen. And it's not an office, it's a kitchen. And that's just not factored in by the employer. So hygiene drops, motivation drops, burnout inevitably ensues. It's math. Jessica is in Milwaukee, and I have never met anyone with her job before. She's a doctor, a forensic pathologist, which means she conducts autopsies to determine causes of death. COVID has had an impact on her job and on her state of mind.
We're kind of at the point where our caseloads are increasing, not at the same rate as, you know, surges in hospitals because of the pandemic, but because of things that might be related to the pandemic, increases in homicides, increases in overdoses, which has been an ongoing trend over the past number of years, not necessarily an increase in suicides, but some over the past year that are directly related to the pandemic and people losing jobs. So it's kind of this slow creep of cases increasing and working for government, which has, you know, limited capacity to increase budgets and build new buildings when our facility is crumbling. So it's kind of unlike other doctors experiencing this really acute stress over the last year here. And I think in a lot of medical examiner's offices, it's been more of an insidious, just kind of slow strain on the system. And that, you know, maybe reaches a breaking point or just starts to manifest in more subtle ways. I think since I started this job 5 years ago, I've kind of changed perspectives a little bit from looking at the types of cases I see as just a part of the way life is and society is, you know, looking at, well, yeah, a certain number of people are going to die every year because of homicides, and that's just the way things are. And same with overdoses and same with suicides. Now that I've, you know, certainly not done this for a long time, but a couple of years, I've started to notice, like, that's not normal. That's not okay that people are dying in these ways. And it's a little bit troubling that it does become kind of, you know, you become desensitized to it and don't start to look at, you know, the fact that people are dying this way because of systems level issues and society level issues. So it's a little bit hard to be kind of a passive observer in ways to that cruelty of the world in the position that I'm in and with the, you know, limited ability that I have to really affect any sort of change. I think once you start to stress the system, you get to the point that you're just trying to keep up with the work and you start to feel kind of like a cog in the machine and not a person anymore. And you start to lose sight of what is the real purpose behind the work when you're just day to day trying to get it done. And you lose sight of the fact that there's a broader goal. You know, the goal of an office like mine is to give families answers about why a loved one died and to accurately certify deaths so on a nationwide level we can understand why people are dying and how we can direct public health dollars and programs towards fixing those things. So you kind of lose sight of that broader purpose when you're just trying to get through the day-to-day grind of things. You know, as kind of an added twist, I do have this diagnosis, more chronic depression, but in the past year was diagnosed with bipolar II, so that, you know, brief hypomanic episodes, but then more often it ends up as depression. It's not something that anybody in my office knows about, although on a personal level, I don't really mind anybody knowing that about me. I think it's important for, you know, people to be open about those things and willing to talk about them. It does seem a little bit like, you know, I wouldn't feel compelled to announce to the office that I have type 1 diabetes. So why do I need to disclose this fact? And I don't think it has an effect on the work that I do directly. But I do think it's intertwined with the burnout thing.
I could have talked to Jessica all day because I find her work and her situation to be pretty fascinating. Before we wrapped up, I did have to ask her one thing. Now, I know that mental health is very complex. I get that. And I know that medicine is complex, and I know everybody's lives and experiences are different. But given that you've dealt with depression and dealing with bipolar 2 and the depression that goes with that, is working with dead bodies who are often dead as a result of homicide and suicide all day long the best profession for you to be in, Jessica?
Well, so the thing is, a lot of my friends, even who are doctors, or just, you know, cops that come to watch autopsies, you know, friends that I have outside of work, sometimes it comes up, you know, how can you do what you do? It's got to be so hard to, you know, be surrounded by death and see all these things. But in some ways, I think that what I do is less traumatic than being something like a pediatric oncologist, where you're treating patients and you get to know them and develop these relationships, and then they end up dying. You know, back to that desensitization.
So your judgment is, could be worse.
Exactly. It could be worse.
Next time on Depression Mode, imagine this, if you can. You have a history of depression and anxiety. You go through a painful divorce involving custody issues of a child. And then you put all that pain into a rap album. It's what Open Mike Eagle did.
In the way that I was writing lyrics and in after I was done recording it, in the way that I was performing them and recording them, I was like, oh, this is some, there's something dark under here. Like there's something that I'm trying to get to.
We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. It is the best form of advertising, and it might help your friend out a little bit too. Also, something that matters a whole lot, please hit subscribe on this podcast and give us 5 stars and write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations going. Just so you know, the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free, 1-800-273-8255, 1-800-273-TALK. And the Crisis Text Line, also free, also always available. Just text the word HOME to 741-741. Depression Mode is your show, too, after all. So let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about. We want your requests. You can email us, depressionmode@maximumfun.org. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. We'll be on TikTok if I can ever not feel silly doing so. And our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack, so search that up. I write about the guests that we've had, guests that are yet to come. There's some notes, thoughts, analysis, plus just a bunch of silly stuff too. And it's free, so subscribe. I'm on Twitter, @JohnMoe, all one word, same on Instagram. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Our theme song, Building Wings, is written and recorded by Rhett Miller, who we like.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason. Maybe there's no reason. I just keep believing. No one knows the answer. Maybe there's no answer. I just keep on dancing.
I'm Phil from Pullman, Washington, and I think you're pretty great.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun. My daughter thought that Maximum Fun sounded like the name of a bouncy house rental place.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.